still first degree. Now, we purposely stayed away from that because we felt that there was a good policy reason to distinguish between the two, and that when you're talking about a dangerous instrument, that how do you prove it's a dangerous instrument if he's merely armed with it? Because certainly under our existing definitions, such as your beer bottle illustration, the man might have a beer bottle in his pocket, but that doesn't mean that he's going to be armed with a dangerous weapon. That beer bottle doesn't become a dangerous weapon until he employs it in such fashion as to inflict bodily harm. Okay, so we stayed away from that. But then they go on to say that in Michigan, that possession then and there of an article used or fashioned in a manner to lead any person who is present reasonably to believe it to be a deadly weapon or a dangerous instrument, or any verbal or other representation by the defendant that he is then and there so armed, is prima facie evidence that he was so armed. And this is an alternative way of dealing with this problem, but then you're still saying that the toy gun is first degree. And whether or not you want to do that is another question. We felt in the subcommittee that there should be a distinction between the toy weapon and the one that can actually inflict serious bodily injury. But,
Professor Platt, there are your words, then and there, in connection with that attempt.
I think it's significant that Michigan and the Model Penal Code formulations of robbery avoid the use of the word attempt. I don't care what you put in its place, and of course I wouldn't insist if you don't use attempt, that's your derogatory, but if it can be avoided, I think it would be desirable.
Now, Chairman, New York defines robbery, and their definition is the same as our section. Well, we can look on page 4 here. I think it's interesting to compare. Their definition is the same as our robbery in the third degree, and then they make robbery in the third degree when you forcibly steal something, robbery in the second degree when you forcibly steal it and you're aided by another person actually present, and robbery in the first degree when you cause physical injury to the person not involved in the crime, when you're armed with a dangerous weapon, or when you use or threaten the immediate use of a dangerous instrument. Presumably, if the well, I don't know what the case would say in Michigan concerning that three there, but it looks to me like if the toy gun is not a dangerous instrument, the use of the toy gun in Michigan, in New York, falls back to third degree or
Michigan has a
definition
of dangerous
New
York.
Now, New York, well, New York and Michigan both define these two. Michigan's definition is almost identical to the New York definition of deadly weapon and dangerous instrument.
The key word in section 2, the one that really want to expand the handguns on representation rather than threatens. Threatens appears up above where we talk about using force. You know, it says a person is guilty of second degree if he violates section 1. We're already talking about the offer of force being made up in section 1. Representation is going to be the key word that might suggest something like. If it's the time of robbery in the second degree, if you violate section 1, and he represents by word or gesture or the display of some, or the display of an object, that he is armed with a dangerous or deadly weapon.
Whether he displays it or not.
Well, the important thing is that he communicates in some manner that he has it. Now, also required in second degree when it refers back to section 1 is the fact that he's threatening force. He's using force. So it could be redundant to include it again down in second degree. You don't need it. Say, I'm going to hurt you. I got my finger. And it's there. The threat of force is there in the representation. Representation being wrong.
Construe being armed to include the man that has the 10 sticks of dynamite in his own black bag 15 feet away. It points out to the bank teller.
He or an accomplice.
What if there isn't any dynamite in the black bag in his case?
He is represented by word or gesture.
That he gets armed.
Or an object, or display of an object.
You just can't get there from
here. The thing that bothers me, Mr. Chairman, is that the full commission in July told this hardworking subcommittee to go back and rewrite these sections, which they did, and then they come back and we jump all over them again.
Yeah.
I'm glad you have.
Well, it's better to do it now than in the courts.
What they do is point out the issues and also eliminate so much that's not good.
Mr. Chairman, I like Mr. Tanger's approach. Several approaches, but I think Section 2 should have some change. Mr. Martin is having a motion which one should be incorporated in, which I'll second. Let's dispose of that motion if we can. I don't know, Bob, whether we'll ultimately resolve this with that. The motion was in Section 2, on next to the last line, following the word any, next to the last word in line 3, to add the words act or. Do you all follow that?
By any act.
Wasn't that correct, Bob?
Not quite, Tony. It was after the insert between the word by and any.
Yes,
insert
that's correct.
The word any act or. As I look at it, I'm not so sure that you can't accomplish the same thing simply by putting a period after weapon and strike the remainder of the sentence.
I think that you need that in there to cover the no situation.
Well, then will you settle for just by any act you need? Verbal, written, or other representation. That's an act. Can't you chop it off just by any act?
What if he walks up and says, I have a gun in my pocket that I will use if you do not hand over $75?
Well,
is that an act?
Verbal act.
Technically it is, but try to explain the instruction to the jury, right?
It does no harm to continue the sentence then.
Whatever you're that one, I guess it's the jury, it's the court.
A typical DA comment.
Except that present to members of the judiciary are not included in that remark.
Well, of course, yeah.
Would you restate that, Bob?
All right, after the word by, before the word any, insert the words any act or.
You've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? I hope not. All those in favor will say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried. We've made progress.
I'll go back to Dave Tanger's suggestion there. What he does in effect is to put that explanatory clause after threatens. Is that what you had in mind, Jake?
Well, get away from the word threat and use their representation rather than.
I was going to strike it when the threat was on. Just plain violate Section 1 and represent by word or
that he is in possession of.
think in our 30 years.
And deadly or dangerous weapon.
Either actual or constructive communication. Mr. Chairman, I suppose John will appreciate it, but I think maybe what we should do is go ahead and hassle through the section 3 and then send it back to himself.
That's all right.
This is what we want to do, is change this to representation. I mean, this type thing rather than the threat, maybe the subcommittee should have another opportunity in the drafting of that rather than us sitting here and trying to draft language. We should incorporate that. But,
I was just thinking, Mr. Chairman, you know, it took the subcommittee about 7 meetings to go through Carson. Mm-hmm. And it took us only 3, or 3A, or 3B meetings to go through Robert. So I'm glad we're going to have a 4-day commission meeting.
But this has come up time and time and time again at every one of our subcommittee meetings. This very thing. We, and all of us I know, are very, very acutely aware of the reason for our existence, and that is try to render the criminal law of the state of Oregon more workable and more concise. And we're not really doing the job that we're charged with if for reasons of expediency or because we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, we accept something that in our judgment is less than perfect. And this is why some of these things are so terribly, terribly tedious. But frankly, I'd rather keep the present law the way it is than have something come out of here that's going to create more problems for the trial judges, create a necessity for more appellate decisions, and we discuss this 3 or 4 times every meeting with the subcommittee, so I'm sure not hurting my feelings, right? This is so terribly important. I agree with John. I really think that that's what we should do, is to go on to Section 3 and see if we can give them the consensus of our feeling on that, and then send it back to them.
You know, I think, Mr. Chairman, I think 3 and 2 are really interrelated. I think if we're going to send it back for purposes of Section 2, there's not really much to be gained by considering Section 3 until we've decided what. Are we going to handle that?
Well, no, we have to make a basic policy decision and maybe review the policy decision that we made at the last commission meeting where we wanted our former first degree robbery draft change. Maybe it seems to me that some of the comments here today is in the direction of being more favorable to the way it was in July than the way it is now.
Well, in July, that's true. In July, it would have been the toy gun situation, would have been third or second degree robbery, plain and simple.
Which is now third.
Right. And then it would have had to actually have been armed with a deadly weapon or using a dangerous weapon to be first degree.
What I meant as far as going ahead and discussing Section 3 is not even acting on Section 3, because I think that probably when we send robbery back, I think the subcommittee should be reviewing to change Section 1 if they felt some compelling reason, and the whole robbery thing go back. But is it the only way we've discussed Section 3 has been in light of Section 2, and I think there are some things like this. I know we got into an hassle last time on this actually present thing, and there may be some other things that we should discuss in sending it back to the subcommittee so they could have the benefit of our thinking on the rest.
I would too. The use of the word attempt and the possibility of using then and there, Michigan does.
George? Chairman, first of all, type and got a thing in all the cases to be investigated. And then being a question of fact is determined by the jury, they'll have considerable leeway. It's going to be impossible almost, it seems to me, that here, in Rainey's law, to contemplate all situations, but it seems to me that's the practical effect of it. The first degree and indictment, and then be a question of negotiation prior to trial, or if it's under submitted to prior to fact, they'll have considerable leeway in determining the degree of guilt.
Thank you, Tom. George?
From the remarks that have been made here, I'm led to believe now that this does go back to the subcommittee that it ought to look freshly at the model penal code formulation and the definition of robbery. I think it does what you all intend to do, with one exception, and that is that it only has two degrees. It does not try to make these fine distinctions that are so difficult between toy pistols and real pistols. It doesn't even mention deadly and serious weapons, and I think it has great virtue. I would suggest that you look quickly at the model penal code, it's a very short section in the blue sheets.
But
you see its virtues. For instance, it says you're guilty of robbery. You can, of course, the name of that. He threatens another with or purposely puts him in fear of immediate serious bodily harm. Nothing whatsoever. In other words, it's the terroristic reaction of the victim, and that's much easier to prove. Whether the gun was loaded or whether it was a thought. That's not really the issue, is it? The issue is the terrorism of this kind of a crime.
That's what the commission in July said that we should depart from and go in the direction of actual danger rather than terror in the mind of the victim.
Well, I think that I get the feeling that we're switching away from that now and refocusing again on what the victim, the effect on the victim is. The model penal code it designates it, depending on whether there's any actual physical harm, designates it a first or second degree felony. And I think they're right. I don't think this is a very serious crime. I really prefer to eliminate that third degree. And if you eliminate the third degree of robbery, you are going to make your drafting job easier, and I think the construction of the section easier when you actually get to the applying of it. Both from the standpoint of the prosecutor who has to draw the indictment and the court who has to make the instruction.
But doesn't the model penal code, in its use of the word attempt, go back to the classic definition of attempt?
Well, it uses attempt only with respect to the grading of the crime. It doesn't use it in respect to the definition. It uses the threats only.
Well, above the grading. An act shall be deemed in the course of committing the theft if it occurs in an attempt to commit theft or in flight after the attempt. Or commission. We come right back to what do we mean by attempt in those situations?
to structure our draft after the model penal code draft would require a departure from the structure that we've been employing right straight through.
That's why I raised the question originally, because I think in reading the model penal code formulation of this particular crime, and I don't want to generalize all the way through, but I think the formulation here is better drafted. The approach is better. It makes it
simpler, isn't it?
It's simpler, it's clearer, and eliminates many of the very problems that we're grappling with here.
Yes, you're right.
What that grading section of the AOI is.
Is it after?
Why?
Well,
it makes the greater felony only where the person actually does attempt to kill. Or purposely inflicts or attempts to inflict serious bodily injury, whereas I think the danger should be prohibited. The danger that might happen, whether it does happen or not.
If he actually attempts to kill him,
Well, it seems to me that the robber might just as well, under the model penal code definition of robbery, he might just as well go in armed with a deadly weapon every time he commits robbery. Because he's not going to get punished any more severely for that than if he just went in and threatened to rough the guy up with his fist or something.
And as long as he doesn't shoot the thing, he hasn't committed the greater of the offenses.
That's why Bruce Pauling said that the tendency of the draft we had before would be for robbers to go in having a gun that was defective or using a toy, which I thought maybe it'd be a good result if that's what it brought about.
But we attempted to employ, I don't disagree with what you say, George, because I think that we have to strive for simplicity. But we adopted a basic policy that we would proscribe any act which would involve being armed with a deadly weapon. And we raised burglary to the first degree in such cases where the burglar would be armed with a gun. We don't want these people to carry dangerous guns. And we tried to say it's first degree robbery, the most severe, or most heinous type of robbery, if this guy goes in and he is armed with a deadly weapon, even though he doesn't use it. And of course, as Jake says, this isn't the way it is in the AOI there.
Well, it's after 12:15. Can we, is there anything else you wish to add as instructions to the subcommittee before this is re-referred?
Maybe the subcommittee is aware enough of what the basic meaning is here of the full commission. I'm not sure I do.
Shall we discuss it further after lunch?
I would suggest we discuss it after lunch.
All right, we'll recess then until 1:30. Incidentally, all the members of the judiciary and the district attorneys can have a copy of our minutes and commentaries for $250. Yeah, I'm Chandler, Matt, and they haven't had lunch, but simply to accommodate the wishes of this commission, they have come up with a new proposal for Section 2 of the robbery. So one of you, whichever one of you wants, can take off.
I don't think I need to go here before necessarily, but what we were trying to do, first of all, I think that the criticism that was directed at our present Section 2 was well taken, particularly the comment by Justice Sloan that we may have inadvertently written into this thing an implication that there would actually have to be a dangerous weapon that was the use of which was threatened by the robber. So in order to try to clarify that, we put some new language in here, and up to the word Section 1 is the same, and then thereafter represents, and then either as an optional or brackets, represents by his words or conduct that he is armed with what, and here's the crucial language, purports to be a dangerous or deadly weapon. In other words, and then of course, words or conduct would encompass the note saying that he had a gun, or the display of a gun on his person, or the use of what looks like to be a gun, a toy gun. What we're concerned with here, and what this section is directed at, is what the representation is, the representation that he is armed with what purports to be, not that he is armed with a dangerous weapon, but a dangerous or deadly weapon. Now that's new too, rather than just saying dangerous weapon and not having the lesser included weapon, as the Senator Turner mentioned, but that either one.
John, I'm sure you talked about this, but why not say what appears to the victim to be a dangerous weapon?
Well, for one thing, I think, and we did talk about this, I think that adds another element in here that the subjective test.
Well, what if the victim doesn't see it?
Well, if the victim doesn't see it, then it's not going to even come up.
Well, sure he is.
Of course it is.
He's going to put the note on them.
Yeah, he's representing.
He says he's.
Well, I mean, the victim's going to see the note.
But if you were to say what appears to the victim to be a dangerous weapon and the victim doesn't see it, why, that's meaningless.
How about a victim who says, I thought it was just his finger in his pocket? lockup, but I didn't want to take a chance.
In other words, the representation and the acts of the robber rather than what the victim actually thought is what we were trying to cover.
Michigan uses something similar to what you suggest, George.
Yeah, no,
I think it's pretty unwieldy, frankly.
Well, I suppose, I mean, I'm thinking of a situation where the guy walks up with his hand in his coat pocket and doesn't have the finger stuck there, so it looks like a barrel coming out. He's just got his hand in his pocket and says, okay, now, I want your money. Well, now, it could be a pistol there, and it might not be. By just his hand in his pocket there, even though there isn't the
jury questions whether he represented.
Whether or not he was representing that he was armed with a dangerous weapon. I think a jury question.
That would be certain conduct on the part of the robber.
What if it is dangerous to get a weapon? Then it goes to.
Then you get out
of
the second degree.
First degree.
But haven't you done away with the second degree in a sense? Mm-hmm.
What purports to be would be lesser included of Judas.
They nabbed him going outside the door, dang if it wasn't a toy gun rather than a real.
May I inquire, is this a rephrase of some other law in another jurisdiction? Or is this?
Well, it's somewhat similar to what Michigan has, in that it's directed at that the representation that he is armed.
I like this.
Rather than that he's threatening.
Smart, closely, and simple.
You need the word his?
We didn't originally have it in there.
Why do you need it? I'm thinking.
I don't think you need it. You're thinking of a situation where you and I go in and.
My partner's got a gun.
My partner's
you
got
don't
a gun.
Hand over the money, you know.
Blue. I don't think it's necessary. That goes better without it.
No, I don't think it's certainly not.
There is one problem with Judge Bruce. I indicated earlier, both Don and Lou, the next thing, pointed out about the situation where the fellow says, the fellow at the door has a bomb, and if you don't give me your money, is he armed under that, or might there be some language such as that he or his accomplice, or you or somebody acting with him?
Well, if there's another person actually present, then it rises to the degree of first degree anyway, doesn't it?
But then we get into argument whether being outside with the bomb is actually present or whether you've got to be inside. Yeah.
Now, maybe scratching and cover someone so unlikely and
frequently. Well, there's another thing. There's another fellow standing here who knows nothing what's going on. You see that fellow with a sack? 15 sticks of dynamite in there.
I mean, all the guy is.
You know what guy is?
He came down to buy some cabbage.
Here. Well, if.
Of course, if you work in accomplice theory, his confederate or even fictitious person, if he's an accomplice, then person two is armed, then under an accomplice theory, person one is armed also.
So but if he's not an accomplice, if he's in part, then you can't join.
He's representing I am vicariously.
Well, yeah, that's going to be the interpretation of what they say on what being armed is. Whether it's actual or constructive.
Of course, some of these have definitions of dangerous instruments rather than dangerous weapons. The Michigan Code, for example, says a dangerous instrument means any instrument, article, or substance that under the circumstances which is used, attempt to be used, or threatened to be used, is readily capable of causing death.
explosion.
Well, I don't think it's going to make any difference whether you refer to it as a weapon or as an instrument if it's, you know, defined.
If it's appropriate, it's defined.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that we decided before mm-hmm. that we wanted to use the language weapon rather than instrument, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, the only word that bothers me is that purports.
Yeah, that's the one we were the proudest of.
Well, it seems to me it takes in all the troublesome areas that solves the troublesome areas we've been talking about all morning.
But
I think my problem is resolved with what Frank suggests, that the court should construe arm as being actually or constructive.
Present.
If in fact it's a toy pistol, and you've got a jury question on whether or not he purported to be armed with a dangerous weapon, and if the defense lawyer can convince the jury that it didn't really purport to be a dangerous weapon, why you're off the hook or slip down to third degree.
That's right.
If he can't, why the jury concludes that in the context the toy pistol purported to be a dangerous weapon, then they find him guilty of second degree.
I don't want to indicate that my mind has changed as you were explaining that. I saw Jack Collier smiling and nodding his head. I want you DAs in the room to take that into mind.
We don't equate justice with convicting everybody.
Just to guilty one.
We've got a session to go after
that
we don't have
in the
principle.
How did the minutes show that the commission is of the impression that armed means actually or constructively?
Any motion?
Yes.
I move we adopt section 2 and Albert.
Second.
You've heard the motions. Any further discussion?
Now, is that leaving out the bracketed words?
Yes.
Maybe I'm nitpicking, or maybe I'm just hear arguments that maybe it's pretty fallacious that it sometimes causes some of this. He's armed with what purports to be. I guess there's no. It's whether he's actually. I mean, he's not. I guess I'm not making any sense, but what I'm talking about is. He says, I'm armed with a pistol and it's loaded. I think that's a better way. I don't think they can argue their way around that. But he's saying that he's really armed and not just purporting to be armed.
Well, that was a fine discussion.
Yeah, it really is. I'm just arguing with So, I'm in favor of this.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion.
No.
Show Attorney General Thornton is not voting.
I'll change my vote, Mr. Chairman.
He votes a die. Okay. Now, number three.
Here, Bob, let me show you how to do that. Take
it, hang them.
I don't work
in
any of
your
stories.
Okay.
Number
yeah,
three, Mr. Chairman,
I'm
excuse me.
That's right.
What kind of a situation would fall within subsection 3? Causes or attempts to cause serious physical injury. Let's say, for example, clearly if you have a fella comes in the plaid pantry and goes to the wherever they keep the 7-Up, gets a quart bottle of 7-Up and comes up and whacks the fella, the checker. Well, that's covered. Now, what sort of thing would fall within attempt to cause serious physical injury?
Cody,
that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess this is probably one of the things that we discussed longest, Ms. Newman earlier, Don and I, we look at robbery in the third degree and have to bear in mind that if robbery rises to the dignity of first degree, if we do things in one in third degree and then plus something else. And I thought that maybe attempts to cause him in the face uses or threatens the immediate use of physical force. And I'd like to hear some discussion on it, Mr. Chairman. I think we've got to look at this attempts to cause in the light of the aggravated assault statute that we presently have. Don, you explain it to me. You explain it to
Well, I was trying to
your position.
I was trying to go back to our minutes when we were discussing burglary, and the same question came up there. You just give me a second here.
We think that I go into your store and punch you in the nose and take money out of your till, that's probably third degree. Because I haven't caused or attempted to cause really serious physical injury to you. But if I go in and knock you down and stomp the heck out of you, there are cases that would bring that type of assault within the great bodily injury section of our present law.
So we intend to do great bodily injury.
And this would rise to that. This is itself to a jury question.
Well, I'm just wondering what type of a situation would fall within this. What type of conduct would come within that section? I suppose if you let's say you had a knife and you slashed it, checked it, but missed it. I suppose that would be the type of conduct that
you would cover. Yeah, this is going to come along with, I would think, under Section 2, uses or attempts to use a dangerous weapon. At least it would come within attempting to use a dangerous weapon.
Well, by way of background on this, burglary in the first degree, early draft on that, we were talking about first degree burglary. We had a subsection in there which would have aggravated the crime if the burglar intentionally or recklessly inflicts or attempts to inflict bodily injury on anyone. And then in the subcommittee, there was a discussion about the use of inflict. This is minutes of May 27th, Subcommittee 1. And we talked about using inflict. And then the suggestion was made that the use of causes might be better rather than inflicts, which by implication seemed to be inconsistent with recklessly. The feeling was that inflicts indicated an intentional act on the part of the defendant at the time. So the thought was that we would use causes rather than inflicts. And we retained attempts in there because at the beginning it was inflict or attempt to inflict. The idea being that, that perhaps the defendant knocked the victim down and kicked him in the stomach. And there would be a question, well, maybe the victim was not seriously hurt, but there would be a question that he tried, that the defendant tried to seriously hurt this victim by kicking him in the stomach. And so that order to cover that kind of situation, where maybe through no fault of the defendant, he didn't succeed in what he was trying to do, that he should still nonetheless suffer the consequences for the attempt to cause this physical injury. So I don't know whether that explains it, but that gave you some of the background and what the thinking was. And then when we came to robbery, we tried to be consistent with what we had done with burglary. And this causes or attempts to cause was carried over from burglary. And the commentary on your first draft of this mentioned that. The first robbery draft mentioned that, where that language came from.
Chairman, I also have a question as to whether or not this will settle the question of what we talked about earlier. What I recall was sort of left undecided. What is our intent by subsection 4 as to who is actually present? Is that specifically covered?
I wondered about that too. I'd like to hear something more.
This is a question that Representative Harlan raised at 9:30, and I said, we'll get to it in just a minute, Dale. The minutes of August 9th subcommittee don't reflect any further discussion with respect to action present. The July 19th minutes from the last commission, as you know, does contain quite a bit of discussion. Professor Platt suggested the use of the words actually present in the previous draft.
On page 15.
Well, Professor Platt asked it to be improvement to say physically present rather than actually present. And our only response to that was both Michigan and New York have used actually present. We got into questions to look at. And it could be profitable to discuss it now.
Well, I think the reason one reason I bring this question up is I just finished trying a case day before yesterday, where the Ronald, I'm not sure I have the name right, but Ronald Miller went into the Platt pantry and produced a gun and said to the clerk, this is a stick up, open the safe, and so on, and so he did. And he immediately left, and by the purest of chance, Mr. and Mrs. John Doe drove up, this is 11:30 on a Sunday night, drove up to buy groceries for tomorrow, and pulled in the parking lot, and Mr. Doe got out to go in and get his groceries, and he happened upon Gerald Miller, the brother of Ronald, and he says, hi, Gerald, and Gerald was standing outside, kind of looking around like this, and the only response by Gerald was, and that was the evidence, and the jury, in their wisdom, went out and convicted him of armed robbery. Obviously on the top of stairs, and it's just that simple. He was standing outside. The evidence also was that after Ronald came out, he walked 15 or 20 steps along the sidewalk, and then the two of them fell into stride together at a faster pace and disappeared around the corner. So it was kind of a classic case of a lookout situation. Now, is he actually present? Of course, in this particular case, there's no problem. A fellow had a gun and so on and so forth. But Seems to me we ought to indicate whether we, whether that type of a situation is one that is not the one we are applying to or not.
Well, of course, the rationale behind it is that we're saying, in effect, that it's having an accomplice there to reinforce the robbery is just as dangerous or potentially just as dangerous to the victim as having a robber who is armed. The Michigan draft, which goes along with the New York approach on this, although New York doesn't consider it as serious as armed robbery, as first degree robbery, they do aggravate it and make it a second degree robbery if he has an accomplice who's actually present. But the Michigan commentary, the rationale is the same whether you call it second degree or first degree, depending on how you classify it. But Michigan says, where two or more persons commit the crime, it indicates greater quality and therefore a greater likelihood that the criminals are professionals. Also, the reason for aggravating the crime is the increased likelihood of an assault on a victim. There is also more likelihood that violence will erupt since each criminal reinforces the others. Inclusion of the factor of actual aid does not affect the doctrine of vicarious responsibility of accomplices for the criminal acts of the principal. This matter is dealt with in the general provisions of the draft covering complicity. Now, in three months.
Well, isn't he, what we actually mean here, whether or not that second person is within such a proximity of the crime or the act itself as to be in a position to aid or render some assistance to the person doing the thing. That's what we're talking about, isn't it? Perhaps we should spell something like that out.
Yeah, but then you get the question, is inside the store? Maybe he is, even though he's not right there standing beside the holdup.
Well, you take, for example, this case I was just talking about. In this case, it was clear that the victim had no knowledge whatsoever of the presence of the lookout.
Yeah.
So he was scared enough by the gun and probably wouldn't have been scared anymore even if he'd known. But of course, I would say in the vast majority of the lookout cases, the victim will not be aware of the presence of the lookout. I mean, in the ones where you've got two people, one stays outside, typically your supermarket windows are cluttered up anyway with the merchandise and signs and so on.
And if the one, say the robber who's in the store, commits what is in fact unarmed robbery, or say robbery of the third degree, because there aren't any aggravating factors, this certainly would not prevent the accomplice who stays clear outside the store or in the getaway car from being guilty as a principal to third degree robberies. But his presence, if he's actually present, and I would deal with this, would mean within the physical presence of the victim.
Well,
that it could, not only would he be a principal, but he'd also be an aggravating factor.
Part of the commentary in our second draft on this was that we were going to have to define actual presence in general articles. Now,
well, is there any other place where we use action?
What was that?
Yeah, on page, page 2 of the Miller Tackle, Water from Way, Lettering Ease. Look at this.
What's the top of the page there?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what it says. Criminal Law Revision Commission meeting of July 19, 1968. It's the drafts for the night of July 19. Page 2 of robbery, court capital book.
Thank you. No, you're talking there about...
I was talking about...
Deadly and dangerous?
Yeah.
Something, if it should be handled, should be handled here, right now.
Well, first, do we intend this to include a lookout?
No. Chairman, feeling that subcommittee of this would be somebody that was there in the store within the range of vision of the victim. Is this right?
Well, I'm not so sure I'd say the vision of the victim, but I would say within such proximity to the victim that he would be in a position to aid the accomplice in exerting force upon the victim.
That could include a lookout in some cases.
Well, it possibly could.
Well, what you're really aiming at, though, is the the added fear engendered in the mind of the victim, plus the added likelihood of violence by virtue of the presence of more than one. This is really what you're keyed into, and
greater chance to be able to run through with the robbery.
Yeah, sure.
You're not concerned about the accessory problem, no?
Well, no, because I don't think the accomplice or accessory law can still stick with that.
Yeah, I don't think. Well, Don, wouldn't you think that what you have just said, regardless whether he's inside or outside, if he is in a position to aid in that deal, would cover this? And the facts would, then whether he's inside or outside, the facts would determine whether or not he was in a position to render aid in the procurement of the property.
No. By rendering aid, you mean some additional assistance over and above mere physical presence, though.
Yes.
Maybe it could be covered in the commentary. Can we cover it in the commentary?
I think we could.
You mean for the type of situation?
But wouldn't it?
But it shouldn't be covered. I don't think it should be covered in terms of, well, this does or doesn't cover a lookout, because a lookout can be all kinds of things.
Yeah, I don't know.
It ought to be phrased, I think, in Don's words, of proximity to the principal actor and the victim.
About the guy that's casing the area before the robbery occurs, do you want to put the words then and there actually present?
Well, I would think so. That's question that Professor Platt brought up earlier today.
So you wouldn't include the guy.
I subscribe to Judge Burns' suggestion that this is the kind of thing that I think would be appropriate to legislative history. But I'm not sure we all understand what we want to reach by it. But I'm afraid, you're right, Judge, if we try to build this into the statute itself, it's terribly unwieldy, and may not cut. The more explanation is in, the more trouble it actually can cause. We're building some things in the comment on the responsibility section. For instance, the jury, the direction the judge should give to the jury in the form of the verdict. We're setting that out in our comment, not trying to set it out in the statute.
Let me make a suggestion of a possible change in the meaning. Is acting in concert with another person without both. Acting in concert with another person, and both persons are within the conscious presence of the victim.
Or in concert with another person then and there present.
Both. First you did anyway, because it was. the cute fellow just as good as the other hands.
Well, that's true. This, we keep thinking about the person who's committing the robbery, but this would incriminate the real man. Because the real man is aided by another person actually present. Well, I mean, just you're thinking of the other participant. Or you've got A and B, one's at the wheel and one's inside. We're thinking about B who's inside. Well, as the other, and you're trying to ask, was A actually the president or not? Simply because he's the wheelman. But if you're thinking in terms of charging A, who is the wheelman, he is aided by another person actually present. He's the only person actually present. The wheelman is aided by the robber himself, and he would be guilty at first.
Based on this. The robber could get, possibly get off with the charge of second, and the wheelman can
just be encompassed. There would be a gap. You follow me, or it's kind of an ambiguous idea. I'm not sure if I expressed it.
But it's rendered moot by the accomplice.
It's rendered moot by the accomplice, and they're both first to
Why is it rendered moot by the accomplice?
Well, the fellow inside, who is really only doing third degree, is an accomplice of the wheelman who's guilty at first.
Well, that's assuming that he's actually present within
that. So then instead of trying him as the principal inside, you try him as the accomplice of the guy sitting out in the car. No,
he's the wheelman. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that is kind of an interesting theory.
Well, I think it's a perfectly literal reading of that language.
Well?
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that. You're saying that the man behind the wheel will be guilty of first degree because he's aided by another person actually present to wit the gunman, or the man inside the store.
But he's guilty of first degree anyway, isn't he? By the accomplice there.
No.
Principal
no.
Accessory.
No. No. What if the guy inside is only committing third degree?
Tell him inside doesn't have a weapon.
He's only committing third degree or second degree.
Well, I don't. That is. But the wheelman is not in the course of committing theft by using or threatening the immediate use of physical force upon another person.
That's right.
He's not doing that because to be guilty of first degree, you've got to violate section one and
doing that
and have the aggravated circumstances specified.
Doing it through the accomplice or a present law, respectively.
Then if he's doing it through his accomplice, assuming that argument, he can only be guilty of what the accomplice is guilty of. And you say that.
Plus his own man.
This reminds me.
Can you tie it perhaps then to the offer of force? More than one person, you know. Offers force. I'm not suggesting my religion.
Jake, isn't this substance that we're trying to say? I'm not, I have no tie to these words, but instead of four, it would be four is acting in concert with one or more other persons located within such proximity of the theft as to be able to aid or assist in the commission of the theft. That could include someone outside as well as inside.
They aid.
And we're not talking here about the fear of the other person particularly. And it would be if he has someone else who's there helping him and these other items are absent, he could still be guilty of robbery in the first degree because the chance of success is greater.
They aid in the commission of the theft if they're accomplice after the fact or if they're the wheelman.
Yes.
It's the aiding in the threatened or immediate use of the physical force that you're concerned with, isn't it? Rather than the theft.
Well, we could change that. I was thinking of a more inclusive thing.
They should want to intercept the mission data by another person. The two people planning are more inclined to be professionals and to success. This is
well, yeah, that was one of the rationales. I mean, that was one of the. But also the fact that there's more likelihood of violence. And, be brought to bear on the victim if there's more than one person.
Of course, they say in the Michigan commentary, the inclusion of the factor of actual aid does not affect the doctrine of vicarious responsibility of accomplices for the criminal acts of the principal.
We ask as a practical matter, when there's a lookout man on a robbery, does that really increase the danger to the victim? Somebody reply to that? Does it really, because he is outside, he doesn't go inside, the victim doesn't know about him. In fact, might it not have a tendency to lessen the danger to the victim because he says, here comes the cops, or here comes the judge, whatever it might be, and they take off before the crime even is committed or finished.
Well, George, although neither of the...
You can see where he's actually inside the room, there's much more reason for agreeing with your rationale of the violence than the threat to the victim. But are we not aggravating the crime? In the case of the wheelman, is that the normal? Isn't that the normal pattern? One guy on the outside and one inside? Can we say that that's the typical robbery?
The kind of robbery that's very common where some brave thug goes in and takes a papa mama's story.
Suppose now that you have this fellow outside in the car, and we're talking about a mom and pop grocery store, it could be a man, it could be anything, and you walk in. Innocent, unsuspecting, and all of a sudden this fellow steps up and moves in. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily, but you said we become an additional victim.
I don't know what the statistics are for our statistics, but my experience has been that there have been more homicides committed in the Portland area in the last 40, 50 years of little grocers, or service station, etc., than robbing, you might say, the $50,000 robbery. On the bank or something of that kind. And those are generally perpetrated, the former, generally perpetrated by one individual. They're extremely dangerous too, because half the time they're hopped up.
George, is this what we're getting at then? Is acting in concert with one or more other persons located within such proximity of the theft as to be able to aid or assist in causing injury to the victim of the theft or others nearby?
That sounds close to me.
Is acting in concert with one or more other persons located within such proximity of the theft as to be able to aid or assist in causing injury to the victim of the theft or others nearby.
He or others nearby runs out pretty broad again.
Well, that's true, but if we would just say the victim of the theft, and there's a teller and two people standing on each side of him, that's why I mentioned that, or someone outside, within the...
I think that's one of the problems. When you start trying to define, you create more problems because instead of now trying to define what we mean by actually present, we're going to have to say, well, what do we mean by nearby? And neither New York nor Michigan addressed their commentary to this problem, but I'm sure that they wouldn't have employed actually in that if they weren't trying to distinguish between the lookout type situation and the situation where there is somebody within close enough proximity to the victim that it could increase the danger to it.
Instead of nearby, you'd say others present.
Mm. Well, first, it seems to me that type of language would be valuable, but I would still be in favor of putting it in the commentary as opposed to in the statute itself. And, I think whenever you try to define, you're going to use other words which in and of themselves are subject to further definition. I think that's what we're aiming at. I think that's what.
Okay, and then let them argue, well, this is distinguished from the commentary rather than distinguished from the statute.
Like the famous track about it. We'll just have to pass it and find out what it means.
Well, I think then if that's the case, if we had the proper language in the commentary, then we could let that this go.
I would certainly think it'd be much better draftsmanship to have in the commentary than in the essentially.
Because I think a very interesting technique to use in the commentary is frequently in the model penal code is to use the hypothetical demonstration in the explanation.
Because really, where this will come up, this will come up at the either the motion for judgment of acquittal, either to close the state case or close of all evidence, and it'll come up in connection with your instructions on elements. What is first, what is second, and so on, the elements of the crime. And this is, the people that are going to be faced with those decisions will be the prosecutor, the defense lawyer, and the trial judge, essentially. And they can read the commentary.
And this
Supreme
Court.
Well, I'm not suggesting the Supreme Court doesn't read the commentary.
You can, that's Sloan's.
Oh, yeah. She takes excellent minutes.
Well, is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, isn't the danger increased that much that she's paid by another person? She's really raising to what would probably be a life sentence as opposed to a second degree. I don't mean to make a recommendation at all. It just seems that it's coming through. Maybe unconsidered, maybe very much considered. So,
this is true, right? Because when this was put in here, it was because when he had the 2 degrees, either unarmed or armed, and maybe this would better fit in the second degree rather than the first degree.
Well, it's a greater danger than third degree robbery. It doesn't seem to be as dangerous as carrying a gun. That's why I say it. Maybe it's still sufficiently dangerous to be first degree, but maybe we're going to consider second degree.
New York, in their former penal law prior to 1965, had it as first degree, and in their revised penal law, dropped it down a notch. Second degree. And Frank's right, that's the reason we started off on this. We're attempting to hold down the degrees of robbery as we've attempted to hold down the degrees of all of these crimes. And
Michigan makes it second degree.
Yes, yeah, Michigan, because Michigan is
second degree, that's their only second degree. Aided by another person actually present.
Yeah, Michigan has followed New York, but New York did previously have it as first degree. They mentioned that in their commentary. So,
Michigan dropped second to.
Well, this is new law for Michigan. This is just in their proposed draft.
But it is in the second one.
Yeah,
that works.
It's a negative sort of suggestion that this thing, in line with what Jake said, I point out the model penal code does not consider the kind of an element that would aggravate robbery and leaves it out and does not let it have to play a part in the degree. Now, that's the policy question.
Actually, when you get into this, I'm not really sure this is the place to start talking about it. It probably isn't, but it's one of the very, very difficult areas presently existing in our law, namely that armed robbery says the penalty for armed robbery is life or a lesser sentence. If in the judgment of the trial judge, a lesser leniency should be shown, or some words to that effect. And I know that these armed robbery cases are terribly bothersome to the trial judges when you get to the point of sentencing. Just for an example, the last one I had, when I went through the sentencing panel with it, there were three of us, and of the three, one recommended life, one recommended 15 years, and one recommended 10 years. It so happened that it was my case, and I had made the recommendation for life, and the other two judges only gave it 15 and 10 years. Well, we talked about it a while and argued about it, and so on, and I ended up giving the kid life. And I suppose in some part, you look at the statute and you say, well, I can't see any condition for leniency here. So it's a life sentence. But day by day, you'll see armed robbers go through and the sentences will range from 10 years up, some even 7 or 8 years. And, I know it's a very difficult thing.
Well, we're not finding it easier for the trial judges, no. We're trying to do it justice.
Well, particularly when the figures show that the average life sentence in Oregon, the president serves about 12 years.
Senator Burns, did you hear the comment by Jake with respect to, in effect, removing this from the first degree, the question of whether someone else is present or not?
I didn't, Mr. Chairman, but I got in on the tail end of some rediscussion and discerned that maybe that's what it was all about. Is it the feeling, possibly, Jake, that you leave this up to the principal accomplice?
No, I raised the question as to whether or not that should elevate simple robbery, third degree robbery, to second degree or first degree. It seemed to me it wasn't really considered. It increases danger. Does it increase danger sufficiently to warrant a life sentence, or should it properly be considered robbery in second degree, or only robbery in second degree? I'm really not even making a suggestion.
New York makes it second degree. Mm-hmm. Actually,
when we had this in first degree, we didn't have a second degree. Now we have a second degree. Maybe it might just as well be in there in the second degree.
I would defy that.
And then what you would do is you'd add this. Section sub 4, make 2 out of that another 4, 1 and 2, and then the commentaries would apply to, well, to this thing in section 2.
Well, we haven't left the use of the words actually said. But
well, no, but we were discussing, I don't know if you were present or not, mm-hmm. that could probably be handled by commentary. Earlier.
Would you do it this way? Section 1 and colon indent 1.
Or?
Like that.
Yeah.
And.
Mm-hmm. I get any better with this chalk, George. You're going to have to get chalk.
Definitely
going to hand it
down for guest lecture.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we amend section 2 by using the formula on the board plus adding in the paragraph relating to aided by another person actually present, so I take that out of first degree and put it in second degree, and that we include in the commentary the explanatory material previously read as being actually present.
I second.
Wait a second. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor would say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
Bob Chandler votes aye.
Now what does that leave us? Now we got Jake Hooker.
Yeah. Now, Mr. Chairman, we go to the crime of arse.
All right, I think don't we still have to adopt section 3, really?
Yes, we do.
We put that back on the... So I'll move we adopt the Kennedy...
Leaving 4.
Section 3. Yeah, 4 is deleted, we put section 2, but I'll move we adopt the Kennedy rule, section 3.
Any...
Second?
Second. Any discussion? Not? Judge Burns wants to say something.
I have one more.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Now, John.
Okay, arson. Arson, without any doubt whatsoever, was the most difficult section or crime we covered in subcommittee. One of the reasons why, and you'll see this, well, you'll see it if you read the commentary, and you'll see it if you go along, is that the present Oregon law relating to arson is tied into the civil law insofar as double and treble damages are concerned. And not very long ago, the legislature in its wisdom amended the Forestry Code and made amendments to several of these civil sections which are affected by the arson or the sections which appear under arson. So when we get into section 2 particularly, you will know that we retain much of the present Oregon law, so we don't do violence to the civil liability statute. Now, we were talking about what is the subject of arson? Buildings? How are we going to classify the property which we intend to protect?
Pardon me, how are we going to what?
The question that we had, Senator, was how would we classify the property that we wanted to protect under the arson laws? Were we going to call it a building or structure, place, whatever? It, we finally came up with the use of this term, protected property. There's a good commentary on it here. Don, I think you're probably better able to explain this than I am. So why don't you kick it up and help me out?
All right, well, all the way through here, we were trying to build upon the basic rationale behind the arson crime. And that is, which is pretty much a two-pronged thing, the protection of public life and safety, along with the protection of particularly cherished or property. Now, these definitions include any property that's customarily occupied by people, and then including public buildings, which is taken from our present statute, because that term is defined in the existing law, and also forest land. Now, under existing Oregon law, this is quite a departure by including forest land within the basic definition of protected property, because that means that the intentional setting of a forest fire becomes first degree arson, whereas under existing law, it's either covered under the Forestry Code or it could amount to property of any other class or character in the statute, which would be third degree arson. So it does upgrade forest fires considerably. And the thought behind this was that certainly in the state of Oregon, a
forest fire intentionally set could cause a serious economic injury to the state. But moreover, there is usually the added risk of danger to human life. So that's pretty much the basic thinking behind this definition. Now, this definition is similar to the definition of building that we have in our burglary article. And it is quite similar if you'll look at the definitions on page 2. We have the text from the proposed Connecticut Penal Code sent out there. The definition of building from New York, and the model penal code uses the term occupied structure. But the main thing they're all trying to get at is structures or buildings or whatever you want to call them where there are going to be persons present.
Let me ask a question based on an actual case. Suppose a husband sets fire to a house, doesn't injure any other body, no intent to fire, and the tenancy by the entire is a guilty abortion. I beat the case.
Protected property.
It's really funny. Paula came in to see me and said, I'm going to be arrested for assault and battery. How's that? Oh, he said, I spanked my wife. And, well, that made me came out and all the rest of us. Yet, call up, made him under $10,000 bail next couple of days. The story was this. He came home and found that his wife was carrying on another man. He lived out in the country. So he went in and did what he said. He spanked her all right. Came out, he washed, and she and her boyfriend came and started to move on her dust and leave. And he made up his mind that he wasn't going to let his wife have the fruit of his labor. So he set fire to the place and burned to the ground. They charged him with arson. They need to take him in because right after the war, when the refrigerators and things like that were right to the top of the chain, I could have taken him out on my feet. Well, he was able to pay a very substantial fee. Besides arson. I don't remember whether the law was amended since then or not, but at that time I was able to convince the court that that was not the proper familiar.
And the law was amended after that.
The law was amended.
I don't know if it's a cause and effect. It was
the Maloney Amendment.
It was the Maloney Amendment was in 59, and they said whether the dwelling house or building is his property or the property of another. It was guilty of arson.
But we also, in this draft, you see, we define property of another to mean property in which anyone other than the actor has a possessory or proprietary interest. So although we talk about property of another, we define what we mean by another. So you're hypothetical, I think, that you would
be. I always remember me that old chestnut about justice of peace was invented charged with arson. Oh, let her marry the girl.
What were you saying, Senator Burns?
Mr. Chairman, I think probably with those introductory comments, it'd be helpful to us in our consideration of this if we go over to page 4 and start considering arson in the first degree first. On page 1, we have the definition, and we are defining protected property, and Don has just explained to you that our rationale was to try to set up those things which we felt would be most serious to violate, such as burning of a public building, burning of forest land, or structure customarily occupied by people. But it will help us, I think, to understand sections 2, 3, and 4 if we start with section 5, arson in the first degree, and work backwards, because we're probably all more attuned to first degree arson than we are to these lesser included offenses. So if that's agreeable, what we say in arson in the first degree is that a person commits a crime of arson in the first degree if by starting a fire or causing an explosion, and this is language similar to what we have in our present law, he intentionally damages protected property of another, or any property, whether his own or another's, and such act recklessly places another person in danger of bodily injury, or protected property of another in danger of damage. Now, you can compare that to ORS 164.020, which is the present Oregon crime of first degree arson, and you will see that this is a departure. So I think we should discuss it so we all completely understand.
I have a question. Maybe you answered it just what you were saying. I was reading here the minutes trying to contradict my client, Jonathan. Is a protected property one that what is the definition of it? Is the
building customarily
occupied by people, including public buildings. Now, do you mean by occupied by people, slept in, lived in by people, or does it mean like a store is customarily occupied by people, but at nighttime it might not be?
Right.
I mean, anything, but I mean, a barn you can say is customarily occupied by cattle, I guess. It's not.
But it's true. Then, yeah.
Before I answer that, I want to be absolutely sure so that I don't.
And then the commentaries start talking about dwelling houses and stuff.
If I can comment on that, this is probably the one single area within this draft that we worked the most on in subcommittee. And if you read through those minutes, you'll notice that we approached this from a number of different directions, and finally we got down to this kind of language, which did not limit the protected property to the dwelling house type of situation. In other words, merely property where people sleep or lodge in overnight. We have not used that kind of language purposely, because the feeling, I think, the consensus of the subcommittee was that there are situations structures where people don't sleep, but that they should be looked upon, the burning of these should be looked upon as a serious, because people are likely to be in there most of the time, or ordinarily. And for that reason.
I mean, an office building during the daytime certainly would be first degree arson. So what about if you burned it at night? We had some custodial personnel there, Carlin working late at night or something.
Mr. Chairman, it would help, I think, if you look at page 2 of the minutes of September 23, 1968. This, I think, was the final meeting that we had on this subject. And I'll read it, if I may.
Yes.
Because I suggested the draft might be creating a difficult area by use of the broad phrase structure, place, or thing customarily occupied by people. If someone burned a boat or car, I said, he could be charged with first degree arson because the question of occupancy could arise. Mr. Paulette explained that the draft was attempting to describe property as a class customarily occupied by people, rather than naming that property specifically. The intent of the draft was not that the state would have to show that a specific boat, for example, was customarily occupied, but rather that it was the type of property which would be customarily occupied. This, he says, would have the effect of putting the actor on notice that the statute covers the kind of property that would be likely to have people in it. After further discussion, the chairman suggested that perhaps the earlier draft, which said, quote, adapted for overnight accommodation of persons, end quote, contained a better cast than, quote, customarily occupied by people, end quote. He said that there was no reason for making the offense of burning up a car with no one in it the same high degree of arson as endangering somebody's life by fire. Mr. Collette advised that under the draft, if the defendant intentionally set fire to a car and didn't kill the occupant, he would be guilty of first degree arson because he endangered a life. Under the present law, he would be guilty of third degree arson in the same circumstance. Even without a definition of protected property, the crime would still be first degree arson under Section 5 if the burning endangered a person. It goes on. I don't know how many of you are following this. I don't know that I have to read it.
Is it?
Just the one that we...
There's some discussion in there, isn't there, from Judge Rodman on this definition?
I think that was...
I think it's really a meeting. Judge Rodman was...
That was an early meeting.
It was on the August 9th meeting. Judge Rodman had that discussion.
Maintain that the draft should place the burden on the arsonist to be sure that there were no people in the structure before he burned it. And that it is customarily occupied by people who do this.
It was not the intent to require the state to prove, as New York and Michigan did, that not only was there someone in the building, but that the defendant knew it or had good reason to know it. The committee had decided at its previous meeting that this would require too great a burden for the state to maintain in order to make a more precise test for occupancy and to eliminate the possibility of charging a person with first degree arson for burning a barn or similar structure. I propose the following amendment adapted for the definition of dwelling house in the present law. That obviously didn't pass. Wanted to eliminate the necessity for it being a lodging house. And we eliminated that, didn't we?
Yes, now, on page 11 of the August 9 minutes, we discussed this. Judge Rodman suggested that